So, Professor Andrew Farmery, today is the 1st of October 2020. Thank you very much for coming and allowing me to talk to you about the recent events and your involvement in the COVID pandemic story. Let's start from the very beginning. I don't want to take you back to your childhood, but where did you do your medical education and your training, and where become interested in anaesthetics? Let's start with that.
I really wanted to read engineering as a schoolboy, but was told by a bossy headmaster that I had to read medicine because that was the rules of the school. So I was slightly forced to go to medical school. I went to Guy's Hospital Medical School in London, because that's where he said I had to go, and had a great time. But I was kind of always more interested in the sort of the mathematics and the physics of the body than in the biology of it. But and I intercalated a BSc in the middle of that, doing mathematical modelling at University College, and then went back to clinical school and found it a bit less interesting, but I persisted, carried on.
Was that also at Guy's, the clinical?
Also at Guy's, yes. Then I don't know where I got this idea from, but I thought I wanted to be a physician. Complete lunacy. At the time I thought I did. And so I did a medical rotation and the membership and all that sort of stuff. Found it absolutely miserable, actually. And this was in the late 80s. It was fairly unreconstructed in terms of medical education and training. And you saw the boss once a week on his way to Harley Street. You had to carry the can for everything that went wrong. And I found it all a bit dispiriting. So much so that I decided I didn't want to do medicine anymore. And my wife persuaded me to take a year or 18 months off and go backpacking around the world, which is what we did. So we went, my wife was doing pediatrics at the time, and she was always considering doing general practice at some point. So this seemed like a good break point for her, and I was about to crack up anyway, so it was a good time for me to go. And so we set off, started in India and Nepal and Southeast Asia, and halfway round, we got to Australia and ran out of money. And so we both did locum jobs for a month or two. And I was doing a cardiology locum in Brisbane. Life was much better there because they had a much more modern way of, training. And I really enjoyed it. And I realized I couldn't go back to London and continue what I was doing, knowing that it could be better. And I bumped into some anaesthetists in the doctor's mess. It's the first time I'd ever bumped into an anaesthetist, actually, because our paths never really crossed otherwise as a physician. But I bumped into them, and they were the coolest guys, these Aussie anaesthetists. And they told me that I should be a bloody anaesthetist when I go back. And I thought, oh, that's not a bad idea. When I went back home, I hadn't got a job, but I did a locum, registrar medical locum at Guy's, just to pay the bills. And I was walking down the corridor one day and I saw this sign saying Division of Anaesthetics, and I wandered down it, and a sign with Professor A.P. Adams written on the door. So I knocked on the door and I said, look, you don't know me, but I think I might want to be an anaesthetist. And we spoke for about 20 minutes, and then he said, well, there are SHO rotation coming up in February. Apply and I'll see you there. And that was it.
Wow.
And then I never looked back, actually. It was absolutely the right thing for me. And I didn't realize until I was 28 or whatever that was the right thing for me. Did that for a bit. And I worked at Guy's and Lewisham. I did a registrar job in Cambridge. And at that point, I kind of thought I wanted to get into academia. And I almost got a post in Cambridge, but just failed to get it at the last minute. And so saw a senior registrar job advertised in Oxford and moved to Oxford to start an SR, an old style SR job, when the kids were very little at that stage.
What year was that, Andrew?
That was actually 96. I first came here. It was between here and Milton Keynes, the SR rotation. So it was kind of 96, 97. And by 98, I got my CCST. Which was a bit quick, because I only started in 94. I'd gone through the system a bit too quickly, as you could in those days. So I thought, well, actually, given that I want to do research, I've got some time, because I think it's a bit too soon to take a proper consultant job. So I then took 3 years out to do originally I was intending to do a DPhil, but in the end I submitted my thesis for an MD because I stopped paying the fees after a while. It got very expensive doing a DPhil, but it was essentially the same thesis, working in the same group, doing the same stuff. And
what was the title of your thesis?
It is called Interrogation of the Cardiopulmonary System with Inspired Gas Tension Sinusoids.
So you got your DPhil, you became a proper doctor at last.
Yes.
And then, or rather your MD, I think.
Yes, that's right. And then, it was time to get a job then. Ideally, I would have liked to have moved into the sort of parallel world of senior lecturer rather than consultant. I thought, well, I can take a consultant job in somewhere like Oxford or Cambridge or wherever, and have just almost as a sort of equivalent sort of career. So I started off as 100% NHS, and then over the years, as I got grants, every time I submitted a grant, then on top of the budget for whatever it was I proposed to do, I would put in half a day of pay for me. And eventually over the years, I've sort of built a sort of bespoke portfolio package where I do about half of my income comes from the NHS and the other half comes from the university, which pays me through grant money that I raise. So I've never actually cost the university anything. I've never been...
Currently, or at least back in the beginning of this year, before COVID started, what proportion of your time was NHS and clinical?
In terms of salary, I would do 2 days NHS, plus on-call, plus trauma shifts at the weekend, etc. But 2 weekdays, I would be in theatre. And 3 days I would be doing university or college stuff. But practically, I work Tuesdays and Fridays in theatre. I was doing on call and I do a certain number of trauma shifts at the weekend. And Monday, Wednesday and Thursday, I was doing college stuff and university stuff.
So when you're at a dinner party and people say, what do you do, Andrew? What do you say? Do you say I'm an anaesthetist or do
yes.
you say I'm a...
It's ingrained. I can't not say it, weirdly.
Okay.
And it just seems more real because that's really what I am at my core.
Right.
If I said I'm a university professor, technically I am, but it's not what I feel I am if you cut me and look at the stripes inside me, as it were.
Okay, So you were doing approximately 50-50.
Yeah.
And then... COVID started and you had a bright idea?
The idea was not mine, at least the idea to do something wasn't mine. I was aware in the days, weeks leading up to the middle of March when all this happened, that the government were proposing that companies like Jaguar and Land Rover and Dyson and Dynarod or whatever might make lots of ventilators because obviously they'll be good at that. And there was going to be a crisis and we needed thousands of them in no time at all. And I remember reading that thinking, well, that's never going to happen. I mean, I spend a lot of my academic time is making medical devices, or two particular devices. And I know the impossibility of doing anything quickly in terms of regulation and the MHRA approvals and registered bodies that would approve these things. So I was skeptical that it could be done. I wondered whether it should be done. Should Dyson and Jaguar and Formula One be all of a sudden doing something they'd never done before? And then I also wondered whether or not the bottleneck was not the lack of ventilators, but the lack of infrastructure and staff to house your ventilators and operate your ventilators and all the other stuff that goes with it. So I was a bit skeptical, and so I dismissed it, mainly because I wondered whether it was the right thing, and even I just thought it wouldn't be possible. And then on... I think it was Monday the 16th of March. You may have to check that that date works with that day. And one of my colleagues here in Wadham, the fellow in engineering, was supervising his DPhil student. And the DPhil student in engineering said, this was the day that the government announced formally this the so-called ventilator challenge. And he'd read it in the paper and said to Mark, this student said, we should be doing something about this. Shouldn't Oxford be doing something about it? If anybody can do this, then surely Oxford Engineering should be able to do it rather than Dyson and Dynarod and QuickFit or whatever. It was then Mark telephoned me and said, I've got this student who says, you know, we ought to be doing something about this. And I sighed and went, right. Not sure it's, you know, really possible. And he said, well, why don't we all just brainstorm and see what is possible? And you can tell us if you think it's not possible and what have you. So there was myself, Mark Thompson, who's one of the engineering fellows, Alfonso Castrejonpita, who's another engineering fellow, and me and Rob Starrup, the student, Zoomed that day. And it was the first time I'd ever done Zooming. I didn't even know what Zooming was, but we did it. It worked out. How are we going to do this? Is it possible to do it? And if it is worth doing, how would we design a ventilator that could be produced 20,000, we were told, in 2 or 3 weeks? And this is the middle of March. So by probably the middle of April, we had to have a design that could have been manufactured at a phenomenal rate. Now, it just so happened that about 2 months prior to this, I'd been around the Penlon factory in Abingdon. I'd been to talk about a collaboration in something or other, but just as a bit of amusement, they showed me around the factory. And, you know, I saw all the familiar bits of kit, like the, you know, Nuffield 200 and their slightly fancier anaesthetic machines. And I saw the speed with which they were being made, which was glacial. It takes, you know, one of those things takes a month to make. And I looked at the bill of parts, the bill of materials, and the hundreds and millions of little widgets and flap valves and pop-offs and solenoids and wires and grommets and seals, all of these things. It was like opening a grandfather clock. So yes, Penlon ventilators are simple, like a grandfather clock is simple, but try and make 20,000 in 2 weeks and you can't do it. We were then faced with the lots of different ideas, and the engineers, being engineers, wanted to do something with stepper motors and rack and pinion type mechanisms and pistons moving backwards and forwards. But the idea of getting those bits and getting an electric motor that wouldn't burn out, getting a 3D printed rack and pinion that wouldn't melt or snap, then I just didn't fill me with confidence. We knew that all the global supply lines were strangled. You simply couldn't get simple things that you needed. You couldn't even get HME filters. You couldn't get the standard hoses that connected it to the wall pressure. Just could not get it. The only thing that we worked out we could get by going on Alibaba, which is like a sort of international eBay, that you can get lots of what I call knockoff Ambu bags. Ambu bags themselves you couldn't get, but a Chinese supplier who could send us a container load of Ambu bags that day if we coughed up some cash. And they were the same as the ones the Trust use, so they were CE marked and they weren't completely hooky, but they weren't Ambu. They were made by, the company is called Marshall, or the trademark is Marshall. So we thought we'd try and design something about something we knew we could get, which was an Ambu bag. And of course the engineers wanted to have some sort of complicated cantilever mechanism strapped around the bag, which a motor would twist and it would screw it and wring it out like wringing out your socks sort of thing. All very clever, but I said, you're not going to be able to make those in time. You won't get them reliably to work. It'll be very difficult. There are too many moving parts. We've got to have almost no moving parts and almost no parts at all, actually, if we're going to be able to source the components, build it at speed, etc., and it not break. And then I went home that night and was sketching various things, and then it dawned on me, there's a very simple technology that we use every day in theatre called a bag-in-bottle. What we could do is incarcerate the ambu bag in a thorax, so we can make a rigid thorax, incarcerate the ambu bag in it, and then all we need to do is control the inlet of air in the, what I call the pleural space, the bit between the ambu bag and the rigid box. And we could make it deliver the tidal volume we want at the rate we want with the IE ratio that we want. There are some niggles that we needed to get over, like how do we get gas into the box and how do we let gas out of the box? Because only by letting gas out of the box will the bag recoil. We could have done it with a clever valve mechanism, but I was trying to reduce the number of mechanical valves. Imagine that you've got a solenoid controlled valve that lets the air out of the box. Imagine if it fails. The bag's compressed and that's it. It doesn't work anymore. And you've got a failed part. So it was all about simplicity and reducing the number of things that could possibly go wrong. And so the only valves we used were what are the ambu valves, the ones with the little silicon duck bills that open and close that at the patient end here. We used that at the patient end, but we also used that screwed into the Perspex box. And that was the valve that allowed the compressed air into the box. And then when the compressed air stopped, the valve backflipped and out it came again. So that was a way of getting around that. Of course, we were still reliant on a plastic moving silicon part, and we weren't quite sure what the life cycle of how many million actuations you could get before they broke. But we thought, well, we can't, it's the best bet we've got. So we went to the IBME, the Institute of Biomedical Engineering workshop, which is a subset of engineering based at the Churchill on the opposite side of Roosevelt Drive, and set about trying to put one of these things together. And we had a fantastic technician who can mill Perspex to within a thousandth of a millimeter, made these boxes, sealed them, got one in. We managed to get some proportional solenoid valves from Radio Spares. They cost 50 quid, which is the most expensive component in the whole thing. And it's a little standard solenoid. It's an electromagnet that controls a pin that blocks or doesn't block a compressed air line. And you can do it proportionately from complete block to complete open and anywhere in the middle. And it does it quite rapidly. So you can inject a flow that you want, controlled by the voltage applied to the coil. So we fiddled around with that and we worked out we could do it. And yes, the bag compressed and the bag relaxed. It was a bit unregulated and we couldn't decide what tidal volume we wanted at this stage, but at least in principle, the thing compressed and relaxed. So this was on the Wednesday, I think, of that week. And so we were quite excited. And in a rather perhaps arrogant Oxford way, decided that we had solved the problem and the government need look no further. And so we thought, well, I'm going to phone the cabinet and tell them that we've solved it and that's fine. We can deliver 20,000. We just need some money to do it. And frustratingly, we just didn't know who to get hold of and there was nobody. There was a management consultancy that was charged with dealing with all of the applicants to this challenge. And so we phoned them up. And they said, oh, well, if you want to apply, you've got to download the application form and fill it in and send it, And I didn't, but I wanted to scream at them saying, we've solved this problem. It was very frustrating thinking that time is running out and the government has basically just posted a note on the village hall saying, roll up anyone, have a go at making a ventilator, which to my mind wasn't the right way of doing it. If I was in the cabinet office, I would have said to the Secretary of State for Health, find out who are the people in this country who do this stuff. They'll be in universities up and down the country. Who are the people who, the engineers and the medics who understand pneumatics and ventilators? Phone up the association, phone up the college, get me a list of names of the people I should be contacting. But they didn't. It was, anybody, roll up, roll up. And it was a little bit frustrating. So there we were, sort of banging on the door, trying to download application forms and filling it in. At the same time, the MHRA had released a list of specifications that it had to have. It had to have this feature, that feature. It had to have this safety mechanism, that safety mechanism, and so on and so on. It was pretty rudimentary, to be fair, and we more than satisfied it, so we were happy with that. We then had to work on controlling the airflow and making it deliver precisely what you wanted it to deliver. So the next few days were sorting out the electronics that would drive the solenoid, and that was kind of working all through Thursday night and, well, all that weekend, actually, was sorting out the electronics. And by Monday morning, we had secured a pitch to the cabinet. So that was 7 days after the initial, you know, thought. And so we presented this, a working demonstration, to the cabinet office on that Monday morning, where we had this thing working with a resusci Annie, you know, with the open chest, and you could see the lungs going up and down. And we had a rough control box, so you could dial up the tidal volume, you could alter the IE ratio, you could alter the frequency. The PEEP had to be adjusted by one of those AMBU PEEP valves that was attached. There was no way we could easily control that electronically. Modern ITU ventilators do it by a pinch valve in the expiratory limb and control of mass flow controllers, but it's very expensive on air, and it's very expensive on components and electronics, and we just didn't have the luxury for that. So we settled for a simple PEEP valve that you could just turn up and down with a spring in it. It's probably a weak point, but, you know,
that decision to settle for that was based on the availability of the bit, that you didn't have to go away and think of a new way of doing it.
No, we just thought there is a device that is already CE marked and approved for this purpose. It's going to make life a lot easier for approval if we just say this is designed and built and approved for this purpose, and we are using it for that purpose. So it was just one headache we didn't need. We presented it to the cabinet. We waited a few days before we heard anything. We were slightly frustrated that the clock is ticking and we're not really doing anything. And in the meantime, do we try and secure, 20,000 solenoid valves, 20,000 AMBU bags and hoses? If so, where's the money coming from to do it? And if we go to the trouble of buying this stuff, and in 3 days' time they come back and say thanks but no thanks, then we're left with all this stuff. So it was a bit frustrating. But about 3 days later, they got back and said, yes, we would like to commission 7,000 of these devices from you. There are a handful of other players in the game who, you know, and not unreasonably, they were spreading their bets and spreading their risks, and that's fine. And they then told us that we were going to be paired with a manufacturer, which was Smith & Nephew, based in Hull, which is quite a good pairing, because they do lots of things, Smith & Nephew, including hip prostheses and stuff. But one of the big things they do in the whole factory is negative pressure wound dressings, which are big sort of plastic cling filmy things connected to a pump so they understand volume and pressure, and they, you know, that's the thing they work on. So they were right up our street in a way. But it meant we had to go up to Hull to see if we could translate this academic prototype into something that could be rapidly manufactured on an assembly line, where you could knock one off every 45 seconds, bang, 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 automated, tooled up to do. And that's a very different challenge. It also had to go through something which I didn't really know existed then, but I do now. It's called a quality management system, which all medical device companies have. It's ISO certified quality management system, which is a whole, it's several filing cabinets worth of paperwork to fill in to detail every aspect of everything you do and the quality assurance and what have you. And that's what they do, and they're good at it, and we would be no good at that. So they were helping us and taking that side on. But the other thing we hadn't done at this stage, we hadn't actually had a built-in the control system. As it stood, it was just an open loop system. We inject compressed air, an amount that we were kind of guessing, to be the right volume to compress the bag to deliver to the patient, and that was it. But that wasn't good enough. We had to monitor the output. We had to measure the flow and the tidal volume and the pressure that we were delivering to the patient. And then we had to feed that information back to the microcontroller to then inform the solenoid, is it doing it right? Do I need to adjust it up? Do I need to adjust it down? You can do control systems, and in modern ITU ventilators, they have control systems that are very, very rapid, and it monitors the output every millisecond, and it feeds back, and it controls the output even within a breath. We were never going to achieve that. It would be too much electronics, and our hardware just wasn't fast enough and good enough for that. But what we could do is to control the output breath by breath, rather than within a breath. So breath one might be a bit out by 10%, but breath two would be a bit closer. By about breath five, you're absolutely what you set on your dial. If you would make the adjustment too quick, the feedback gets a little bit unstable and it oscillates. So you basically have a build in a damping system. So I want a tidal volume of 500 mils. If it delivers 400, its next one is of modest adjustment, and then and so on and so on, and it's a damped arrival at 500 rather than oscillating either side, which is what you would get if it's too quick.
What happens if the patient coughs whilst or moves or something?
Well, this at the moment the NHRA specification requires this device simply for people who are paralysed and heavily sedated with severe ARDS who are not well enough to be breathing. So at the moment, we're building it to spec. This is for the emergency thing in 3 weeks' time when the Nightingale Hospital is full and they're all got serious lung injury and there's no way on earth they're going to be breathing on their own. So they're all going to be hammered with midazolam, morphine or whatever, propofol, and this is just a basic ventilator. So we had to build a control system. We also have to build in sensors. We have to have a means of measuring the flow. We have to have a means of measuring the pressure. So we've got to buy some flow differential pressure sensors, some absolute pressure sensors that we have to build into it. We have to build a circuit board that can be mass produced. And we're racing against the clock in Hull because we've got a date to deliver a working prototype to the MHRA in a week's time. So we've only got a week in Hull, or actually 8 days, I think it was. And it was very frantic, and we didn't sleep much, and we were all falling out with each other and getting cross with each other. There were 10 academics went up from Oxford, including me, another professor in engineering, some postdocs, some DPhil students, and a medical student, one of my students, in fact. And we all lived up there for 10 days, and it was a bit frantic. But we tried and things failed and things, then we got things working again, and it was very sort of high and low emotionally. It got to the point where we were needing to deliver this to the MHRA on the Sunday morning or something, and by the Saturday or the Friday night we still didn't have the circuit boards made. We'd had the prototype ones that we soldered ourselves, but we needed a proper working device to go to the MHRA with proper piece printed circuit board. And they were being made by a company in Andover and we were in Hull. And they said they will be off the line on tomorrow morning, but we hadn't got time for them to be driven from Andover to Hull. So my medical student, who was previously in the RAF and worked on helicopter weapons systems, phoned up her friend who's still in the RAF and managed to get the Queen's private helicopter with Her Majesty's permission to deliver these circuit boards from Andover to Humberside Airport. So we all raced off to the airport to watch the Queen's helicopter land. This box of circuit boards come out and go across the tarmac. They go in the back of the car. We go back to the factory. And then we're frantically fitting these things in, and then they've got to be programmed. They have an EPROM, a programmable microchip in there. So they had to be programmed to have all the calibrations that we'd made and what have you, had to be burned into them. And then we made a decision the next day not to send it to the MHRA because we simply hadn't tested it enough. We'd only just, the paint was still wet, you know. And I figured that I would rather have a delay than send something that would fail and we would look bad. So we just said, look, we just want a few more days just to characterize the performance of it and be certain. So we bought a few more days and sent it off to the MHRA. As we sent it off to the MHRA for them to establish it, we got another revision to the MHRA specification to what they required. Whereas originally it just needed to be a simple volume control ventilator where you can alter tidal volume, frequency, i.e. ratio and PEEP, which is what we delivered. Now, could we include pressure control? Well, no. If you'd told me that at the start, I might have thought about it, but it's not really possible with the bag compression system. We can't really do pressure control ventilation. We now need a spontaneous mode, an SIMV type thing, or pressure support for spontaneously breathing patients in the recovery phase of the disease. Well, you didn't tell us that at the start. And now this has been built, it's gone through the quality management system, it's now off in the MHRA being tested, and now you've changed the goalposts. So we then, when we got it back from the MHRA, which of course it didn't, it got tested and it fitted the original spec, but it didn't suit the new updated spec. So we've now got a week to completely redesign the system. So it's now will detect breathing, will trigger, and will deliver a volume. It's still a volume control ventilator, but it does something called ACV, assist control ventilation. It's what's used in the United States as their main support. In this country, we use pressure support, but in the States, it's assist control, which is it detects the patient's attempt to breathe, and then rather than giving a fixed pressure, it delivers a fixed volume that you decide. So we then had to set this up on a spontaneously breathing mannequin, which are very rare. We had to then drive to the Royal Surrey County Hospital in Guildford, where they have a simulation suite with one of these state-of-the-art simulated breathing dummies that breathe spontaneously. So we could see what level of muscle force from the patient would be required to trigger. So we have an adjustable trigger, which we can have to put a new button on now, which is the adjust for the trigger. Do I want it very, very sensitive, so the slightest cough or fart will make it trigger? Or do I want to up the threshold so the patient's really got to mean it to get a breath? So it's user selectable. And so it basically detected a dip in the PEEP value, the pressure, the very last pressure that precedes inspiration, whatever that is. If it dips more than 10% or 15% or whatever you set, it takes that as a trigger and then it will deliver a preset breath. If the patient fails to breathe, then it goes into a backup mode that you can also set. So now it's got much more complex. We didn't have that before. We've got to go and rewrite all the quality management system. We've got to rewrite a whole set of alarms and all the stuff that... That informs the alarms and what makes the alarms work. And so there's a lot of work to do that. But we did it and we sent it off to the MHRA saying, hurrah, we have now done the thing that you asked us to do. And they assessed it and it passed all of their tests for accuracy and safety and all of that stuff. And then the following day, we heard from the Cabinet Office, I got a letter from Michael Gove and from Matt Hancock saying, thank you very much, Professor Farmery. It's been a wonderful achievement, but we don't need them anymore. Which, of course, you know, I'm delighted that we were in such a good position that we didn't need them. But boy, the whole journey was a bit rock and roll.
But we mustn't hold our breath for too long. We don't know where we're going still.
Yeah.
And what you have created is still going to be of value in the background.
Yes.
Nightingale Hospital is still up and built, and it might have been mothballed or temporarily mothballed.
Mm.
But I gather that they're now reconsidering that position and whether to get going again.
Well, we've had 6 months for Penlon to make their proper ventilator, and they're hopefully ought to be 20 odd thousand more ventilators now than there was then. The thing about then was that we need this huge number in this really short space of time. Now we've had more time and we should be better prepared.
Do you feel frustrated?
It was frustrating at the time. It was a combination of being very tired and frustrated and all those things. When you're tired, everything is a bit rubbish. And I remember there was almost a month when I never really slept properly because I was either in the workshop, in the lab, up in Hull, or thinking about stuff. And it was frustrating. And I felt a bit, I wasn't frustrated that we didn't need it. I was delighted we didn't need it. I was frustrated with the way it was handled and the way it was done. And this notion that we were in a queue with all sorts of crackpots and weirdos with, you know, ideas, you know, let's make one out of cheese or something, you know, rather than being targeted or being, you know, not necessarily me, but people like me up and down the country should have been, got together in a room and said, look, guys, this is on the horizon. What do you reckon? How would you tackle it? What would you do? Who are the people we should be? Da, 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 da. That's how it should be done. But it's a very Boris way. Oh, I've got a friend I was at Eton with who runs a vacuum cleaner company. You know, that's so it was that thing that slightly it was irritating.
When we first discussed this discussion that we're having now, you said to me that Sniffer Nephew actually had ordered and purchased and, I don't know, manufactured several thousand of these.
Yeah, complete units we only have. No, hundreds probably, not thousands. But we bought all the bill of materials. That's all the parts. We spent £7 million on that.
Of whose money?
Taxpayers. That came from the government.
From central government.
And then they bought it all back when the whole thing was not needed. They bought all the parts back. Or no, took all the parts back because they owned them. But of course, what would they do with 7,000 solenoids and things? So we then set up a company, a not-for-profit social enterprise company called Oxvent, whose purpose is to really help healthcare jurisdictions in low, middle-income countries who might need this now or in the future, or even post-COVID, actually, just as a general purpose ventilator. And so we then negotiated with them and we bought them back off the government for 10% of the price. So we've done quite well out of that. And so we are now, we've just about to get, I've heard positively, FDA approval, which is the US sort of equivalent of MHRA. Yeah. And we've been working with a company in Brazil and the healthcare authorities in Brazil and in Mexico. There's a manufacturer in Brazil and a manufacturer in Mexico who will be, the moment we get the FDA, will be manufacturing these in volume using the components we've got, plus buying new parts now the supply lines are open again. So there will be 7,000 going to Brazil and Mexico, plus some more being made. And they're our sort of test area. And then the idea is that we will make, you know, the know-how freely available to any jurisdiction that needs or wants them. And the only cost really is just the cost of keeping the infrastructure going, which is nothing much. It's a company that's owned by the university and it's not for profit, but it pays a handful of admin people basically. So it's not very expensive to run.
It sounds an incredible, I'm not a layman, exactly, I'm an anaesthetist or was an anaesthetist, but hearing your story, it sounds a remarkable achievement to have taken the idea and turned it into an actual working, not even a prototype, much more than a prototype. It was an actual ready for going on the manufacturing line. And the total time taken from A to B was?
Well, from first having the idea to getting the prototype to the cabinet was 7 days. I have to go back and look at my photos on my camera because that's where I get my timeline from. I think there's a photo of me smiling, holding this box on the Smith and Nephew line, the first, you know, commercially sort of, I think that might have been 6 weeks. to do that. Maybe less, actually. Perhaps it was late April, so it might be about 5 weeks, five weeks. Admittedly, the MHRA authorities had something called derogation. So they'd sort of downgraded the multiple hurdles you've got to jump over for a medical device. It was still pretty grim and bleak doing all the stuff, but it was a lot better than it would have been in peacetime.
Right, sure.
If you know what I mean. So there were derogated regulatory powers or something like that. I think that was the word. A bit easier, but it was still, I mean, the admin side of it was as hard as the engineering side of it, which is why Smith and Nephew were invaluable.
Oxvent lives on and will continue to live on, but it may not yet turn a profit.
Yes. And since knowing now, I mean, we built this, as I explained, because of the need at the time, and it was a volume control ventilator because it was, I thought if you can get a ventilator that is as good as a theatre ventilator, that's going to be good enough. But it's never going to be a fully functioning ITU ventilator. So since then, I've had another idea, which we're working on the Mark II Oxvent. And I've had a student working on this over the summer. He's now term started, so he's got to go back to do his studies. But we've made a huge progress, actually. And we basically developed what I think is almost a fully functioning ITU-type ventilator, which delivers pressure control ventilation, of a fixed upper pressure and a lower pressure PEEP with, an IE ratio you want. I mean, it can be volume controlled as well, but it needn't be. But it's a pressure control ventilator, variable peak pressure, variable PEEP, IE ratio, frequency, blah, 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 with no valves at all, not even a PEEP valve, zero valves. And it's done with fluidic logic using basically fluid dynamic theory.
Is that what the NUPAC ventilators worked on?
No. They did use fluidic logics in that they had shuttles in them. They had valves in them. They had a big that clunk that you could hear was the timed box that when it got to a certain pressure and you could adjust the time constant with a little screw, it flung a spool, like in a cotton mill, boom, to the other side, and then it cycled the other side, and it did that back and forth. It had moving parts in it. It's simple, it's good stuff, but you've got to make one of those. If you open up a Nuffield 200 or a NUPAC, there's lots of stuff in there. You've got a mill steel, and you've got all that stuff. This uses a sonic nozzle, a nozzle that injects gas over the speed of sound. And then all the laws of physics break once you do that. And so you can do stuff that ordinary physics doesn't let you do. And you can 3D print these things and they cost 10 pence to make. That is the only part. The rest is compressed air. And some electronics, of course. The same electronics that just controls the compressed air. But that's easy. But you can generate PEEP simply by delivering in the same way that you can generate a pressure up here in inspiration, you can just generate this whatever pressure you want in expiration as well. And we'll call it PEEP because it's expiration. So it's just using that kind of logic. I can't imagine why nobody's done it before. Somebody must have done it before because it's so simple. The idea is so simple. So my nagging fear is that it won't work. There'll be something that won't work. And I can't work out what it is. But on the bench, it seems to work. And it's, with a dummy lung, it seems to work. So
I was always terribly impressed with something which I think was called the auto vent, which was the thing about that size, which looked like a Rubin's valve. But in fact, when you connect it to a high pressure oxygen supply, it worked as a ventilator. It was a flip-flop valve with a magnet or something inside as well. I mean, people
You could use that. They've used that in the army, in the field.
Yeah,
it's not controllable. You can't really control anything. You just get some gas going in and some gas coming. I mean, it's fine for getting someone off the battlefield, but if we need something in this day and age, it's going to be equivalent to an IT ventilator.
When you think that in my generation we went from the Manly ventilator, which was high tech when I started out, and now we've got these things that are bigger than my desk. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story about the Manly. On about the time this was happening, I got an email from the CEO of Bleas, or some subsidiary of Bleas, that now do something else. But Bleas then took over Manly and effectively owned the Manly trademark. And the government had, or somebody had advised the government, all you need to do is make a load of Manlys, they'll be fine. And so the government had got onto Bleas and said, can you make us a load of these Manly ventilators? Anyway, the CEO of Manly emailed me to see if I had got a Manly, because they hadn't got any and they hadn't kept any of the blueprints or any of the details of it at all. And they wanted me to supply them one so they could take it to bits, reverse engineer it and build one. I said, look, I haven't got one. You can probably get one from the association. You can get one from the Science Museum. But believe me, if you dismantle that and rebuild it, you will build one every 2 months. It is a complicated bit with 1,000 bits. And you're going to have to set up a tooling in the plants, in your plants, to make every widget and every spring and every clip. Not going to happen. Forget it. And I thought, why am I telling the CEO of Manly that? Surely he must know that. So, the other story I must tell you, Mike, is when I was thinking about this new Mark II and whether using fluidic logics and jets and sonic nozzles and things, I had a vague idea how they worked. And I remember once reading a very good book where a lot of the complex physics had been described and the mathematics had been described really comprehensively. And it was not a standard anesthetic book. It's a book written by Keith Dorrington thousand years ago. So I remembered I got it on my shelves here, but I couldn't find it. And so I emailed Keith and said, look, Keith, I remember once reading this book that you'd written years ago, and it got all the complex physics and fluid dynamics. And I think I need to brush up on this stuff. Can I borrow the book? He put it in my pigeonhole at Wadham. I opened the front page, and it said, I'd like to, you know, thank a number of people who basically guided my career and made me end up where I am. Foremost among them, Dr. Mike Ward.
Wow.
Yeah, you're mentioned in the beginning of this book, who even as a medical student, stimulated my interest in blah, 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 blah. So there you go. That's when I read your name, just as I was mugging up in his book.
Extraordinary. Well, there you go. So, have you finished this story? But is it a story that's going to run on and on? Is it going to continue? What's going to happen? In 2 months, if we find ourselves in the middle of the second wave, do you think medical management of these patients has improved to the point at which not as many will need ventilators?
In the UK, we were fairly conservative anyway with the use of ventilators. I think in the Northern Italy experience we'd seen in the weeks before. And, it's very much like standard ARDS. Ventilating someone is very much a last resort, because you almost do as much harm as good when you ventilate someone with this kind of injury. And that we've known that for years, and so that hasn't changed. And so, you know, your threshold is quite high for ventilating people. So you start off with CPAP and non-invasive support and prayer and all those things. And then only if it really looks like, you know, what have we got to lose, do you go down the ventilator? And that will be the same. If we get something that's worse than we had in April and May, we might be short of ventilators again, but hopefully they've stockpiled a load of those Penlon ASEs or whatever they're called in a warehouse somewhere.
What a wonderful story. And I know you're not going to be rich as a result of it. The college might earn a bit, I don't know. Oxvent, I don't think, has had the publicity it deserves, but hopefully it will. But not for the wrong reasons. I'm very grateful for your time to tell me the story. It's a fascinating story. Anything else you want to add before we bring this to
I think that's it, really. I mean, I was very, very involved in it at the time, and I'm a bit less, well, quite a lot less involved in it now. And the Oxvent company goes on, and Mark, my engineering colleague, is much more involved in the sort of management side. I've really kind of stepped back and I'm back doing the day job really now, but I still, you know, I'm interested to, and I chip in and join in occasionally, but it's not the focus of my thing now, as it were.
But, on behalf of the association, thank you very much for your time. It's been a fascinating hour. Very grateful.